Hello again, folks. Welcome. This is Julie Knutson with the podcast Turning the Pointing Labrador, episode number 122. And in case there's any funny background noise on this stuff, it's because we have 60 mile an hour winds outside. Thank goodness it's a Sunday. It would be a little hard to be doing stuff if this was a regular work day. So I apologize for a little bit of maybe some funny background sound, but it's not possible unless I went into the closet and shut the door to get away from a little bit of a hum in the background. Today's podcast is going to be out of basically demand, going to be more listener questions. I got a tremendous response out of the, you know, learning to be a little bit better trainer by yourself. And I plan on continuing that topic a little bit because I think people enjoy approaching that and finding ways to maybe get a little bit better over the off season. But I asked some questions and I have some fun questions, but people ask me real sincerely, so I try to get on them. If, you know, it's a puppy question and I wait a month, then we're out of that and into a whole new stage. So I'm trying to get to these things quickly. But one of the first questions I had was to explain my take on introducing a young dog to gunfire. And so that's an important thing. And when you've never done that before, or you've been around people who act like it's just going to be this is just a really big, big deal, you can get real worried and concerned about it. And I started in with the competitive retrievers, and nobody ever talked about dogs being afraid of gunfire. And to be honest, I didn't even know it was a problem. It could be a problem. It was, I don't know how many years. I guess when I got out of just my own training group and my own dogs and got to where there were other people and other dogs, that I even knew that was a problem. And I know it can be, you know, it really can be a problem. I'm not making light of it. But it's a fairly easy thing to not have when you go about it in a way that makes sense. Now, I remember when I first was hearing about this problem, or I was reading, I can't remember, somebody's book a long, long time ago, because I do try to see what everybody else says and what they think and the other ideas that are out there, because there's always good stuff. But, you know, there's the pot banging deal where you're feeding your puppy and you're banging pots because you want to get them to associate loud noises with pleasure. So, I just wonder, you know, what they're going, what the heck are you doing? Or just whatever, do whatever, I'm just happy to eat. There's all kinds of ideas and stuff, and I'm not saying there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I've just never irritated an animal while it was having dinner, so I've never found it necessary. But just let me tell you, instead of just kind of making light of stuff, how the zillions of puppies that have come through my world and that I've been involved with, kind of how we do this. Now, if you have a dog that's just inherently is a little puppy, a very, very shy, timid animal, okay, the last thing I would do is start banging stuff around and making them feel more timid and more afraid of the world out there. I would not do that. And frankly, I don't do that to any dog, the boldest guy in the world or a real timid one. But certainly, you know, if you have a breed that is a very sensitive animal, that's not a bad thing. But you want to understand that whatever it is, whether it's a Chesapeake or whether it's an English Pointer or some other complete other kind of dog that's going to be around gunfire, yeah, that would include canine, the police dogs, you know, they could be around that as well. And so a lot of different kinds of dogs at some point in their working career may have to be in fire. Around that, but it's not just a loud noise. If any of you have ever been around a shotgun when it is being fired, and preferably like inappropriately around it, like one, shooting it, and two, kind of beneath it or just off to the side, there's not just noise. There is the concussive force, and it's pretty strong. I mean, it'll ring your ears for quite a while. And, you know, those of us that have been around guns for a long time are definitely more hard of hearing. I mean, we've just wrung the snot out of the eardrum and it doesn't function as well anymore. And, you know, the military guys, boy, they really know about that. So it's not just the loud noise. It is the concussive force. And that is nasty and horrible. And you certainly don't want that to be something your dog experiences out of context, preferably ever at all, but certainly out of context. And so how do we get these little guys to approach this with the passionate, you know, love of it that you have if you're listening to this? So when you have little guys, again, I don't go on the annoy them with loud noises things, because the gunfire is a lot more than just that. So the first thing with these, with the dogs, now they need to have, they need to develop, have a real interest in something. If you have a hunting dog that has no interest in hunting, or in retrieving or searching for stuff or using their nose, or the prey drive thing where they want to go find this little deal and in the beginning, you know, eat it themselves. If you don't have that, leave gunfire out of everything entirely. Because here's something they're not interested in, accompanied with a very loud and obnoxious noise. There's no upside to that. So don't do that. Okay, first thing you have to have in this little dog is whatever its function is, the retrieving, the hunting, that it has a great interest in that. So no big loud noises or out of context anything. Start with, you know, with your little dog when you get it, 8 weeks old, nine, whatever it is. Okay, what if you got your little, you know, upland pointer guys, then go do that stuff. If they're retrievers, then go ahead and start the retriever with that, retrieving stuff with them. For those of us with retrievers, then get that going. You know, and if they retrieve at 6, 7, 8 weeks old, then do it a couple times a day. Do not, this is the 187th time I've said this, do not do 20 retrieves until they are bored or starting to create ways to make it more interesting. Do, and this gunfire thing is a part of this, for those of you that often wonder why I say two or three, plus everyone else in the world that's good at this says two or three as well. The reason that you just want a couple retrieves is one, so that they love it and are giving it everything they have and are entirely focused on it. And then when you stop after just a few, and just a few is not seven, right? Just a few is two or three. I'm gonna put four on my outside. I have a fire-breathing dragon and I'm going to do four. Then you stop, because not only then have they not created things to make it more entertaining, not only then have they gotten slightly bored and maybe pick it up and go sniff something, then come back to you. So you start to interject negative behaviors in the middle of that you do not want. But because they really, really, really want to do it again. And that feeling in these little dogs is the thing that we're looking for. No, 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 do it more, do it more, do it more. We want that. And so you do that, maybe you do retrieves morning and evening. And then the next day you do them morning and evening. And you just, what you do is you make the retrieves as the dog gets more mature, you make that there more challenge in your two or three or four retrieves that you do. You put more challenge. You don't put more retrieves. You just, they're longer. Maybe you've got some cover now. Maybe you've got some stuff they have to go through. You do some in the water if you can. So you make those few retrieves that they do more challenging, so that they become better at retrieving, that they learn more of the factors that they're ultimately going to have to be involved with retrieving, by the nature of where you put stuff and when you have to get a thrower in there so you can get it a little further out or get it into a specific place because you're sitting there holding onto the puppy. Right, so build that passion. So when you put that bumper away, they're just going, no, 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 let's do this again. That passion is really important. No hurry on the gunfire. So what you do is you get your little puppy where they, you know, when they see that someone's going to throw, and I'll tell you this, do not do this by yourself. Get somebody, whether it's your partner, a kid, the neighbor, yeah, somebody in your club, dog club with you, get something. And if you don't have somebody because you live out in the middle of nowhere, then get some of those little things that actually toss stuff with a little gun on them. You're going to have to pay money. But what you want is when your dog is loves retrieving, you know, and in the beginning, they can't see as far as you can throw. But as they get better and better and they mature, okay, pretty soon they can see that. Now what we want to do is bring in, I don't care if you're never going to compete or you're going to compete, or I don't care what. Your end use is not a factor in this. We want now somebody away from you and this pup to begin throwing your puppy bump or whatever you've got. They're going to throw. So first, the first thing we've done, right, is we've got this dog passionate about going out there and getting out and coming back. And now you're holding, even the little guys, if they're real passionate, then hold on to them. Do not let them think they're out there fielding and you know, they come in, fling the bumper at you and run out to field some more. Don't do that. There's no place in hunting where that's good. That's how dogs get shot. So as soon as your dog is really excited about this, or even just kind of excited, hold on to the little guys. And, you know, in the beginning when you're throwing it, hold on to them, throw it, it hits the ground, send them. Convention is send them on the name, but that's not what this is about. So send them, have something that you consistently send them on. So all of this is crystal clear in their minds. And now get your partner, whoever it is. And so they go out there with the puppy bumper, and the dog is being held. Okay. And your gunner goes, and this is well written up and demonstrated in the book. This is on how to introduce this stuff. The book, Training the Pointing Labrador. So have them out there and go, hup, hup, and get the puppy looking. And then when they're looking, they throw this puppy bumper in a nice big arc, and where it lands somewhere the puppy can see it in the beginning, right? So, and they, now this could be confusing. And there's, again, this is really written up in the book. But you may have, if your dog, you may have thrown so much for your dog that now whoever throws the bumpers where they go back, you can just work past that. Have them where they can't get back to the thrower. Have the thrower near you throwing it way out front, and then they disappear behind you. So the little dog learns no matter who threw it, where it initiated from, it always comes back to you. So that's something you got to work through. Just outsmart the situation. Again, if I have one of those little returners like that, I'll throw it for the person. And when the dog's out, I'll just disappear back behind them and I'm out of sight. So then they begin to learn, I always bring it back, you know, to you. So you get that. And again, you know, these are walking singles that we're going to do. We do one, then we walk away from where we threw it. We walk away from where we threw it, and we throw another one, maybe a little longer. If that's too long, then the next one's going to be shorter. Always carry another one. Now we're getting off the gunfire, but carry another one. So if they get lost out there and can't find it, or it rolled into a hole or something, so when they're not looking, you do the little hup and chuck it in the air, and they turn around and see it fall. So that way they don't run back with nothing, because remember, that's one of the dog sins. You never return with nothing. So get them where, and this takes, I don't know, usually several days, at most a week, where they go, oh, there's somebody standing out there. Yay. Right? So they're standing out there and you go hup, hup and get the puppy looking. The guy handling the dog, do not move their head, use your hand, do anything. Just hold the puppy. The gunner gets the tension. Hup, hup, throws this thing. You send them. Little puppy runs out there and gets it. If they're not just wildly interested, let them go while it's still in the air. So that's more fun, right? If they're wild and crazy, make them stay there till it hits the ground. Common sense stuff. So they go out and get it, and they come back, and you do maybe two or three of those, four if you just absolutely have to, and stop. So now the sight of this person out there away throwing this thing is a really big deal. Oh, man. So again, this is not 2 days. This could be a week or so until they really get this. So now you do not begin to introduce noise with this until that little dog is very excited about this. It might happen if you start, you know, throwing for stuff when they're 8 or 9 or 10 weeks old, you know, and by the time they're 12 weeks old, they are just like spit is flying, right? They are just, oh, okay. Maybe then after a few weeks of this hup hup throwing stuff, okay, now they're so excited and they love it so much, now we can introduce noise. If they are not super excited about this, if they're somewhat excited about this, we're not going to introduce a new potentially negative factor. We're going to do either one or two retrieves, and that's all. And depending on the interest level, if it's truly moderate at best, maybe do one or two retrieves every other day. But anyway, you can't make them love this by making them do more of it when they're only moderately interested. You have to, this needs to be the highlight of their day. If you do have a disinterest problem, that's another podcast. If you have a disinterest problem, then do less of it, but don't make this be the worst part of their day. If all the time they're getting, kids are throwing toys around and they're just in the house playing and rambling, and then you're going to go throw stuff. They're like, this isn't fun. I don't want to do this. The highlight of their day needs to be this work. So if something is way more fun that's not this, you're not going to increase their excitement about it. So this needs to be the highlight of their day until they're like, oh, I really like this. And they consistently, and they're getting, where they're really excited about it. Now, and here's the whole point of this question. Now when you do this, have your person go out there, and if you're worried at all, have like a starter pistol. A little pistol with blanks in it. Do not take your 12-gauge shotgun out there and start with that. Right? You can go buy kids' toys, a little cap kind of pistol. I don't know if they have those anymore. So that you have a pop. Blanks are really nice. The 209 primers that you use in shotgun shells. They have guns where it just pops a little 209 primer on there, so you get a gun-ish noise. So what you're going to do, and this is how you first do it, okay? So your dog really likes retrieving. So your gunner is a major part of your help. Like I said, read the book on that. The gunner is hugely important. So I'm your gunner. You're holding the little puppy. Okay, I walk out at whatever distance they can do, but it's fun. It's not just super easy. They can go out there. I'm kind of on the grass, so we're not going to have any trouble finding it. First time, when I have my cat pistol, first time, I just hup, and I throw my bumper. Okay, they run out there and get it right, and they run back to you. And I move away from that to throw my second one so they're not related. I move away from that one. All right, this time what I do, and this is real important. So the puppy, if you've been doing this, your puppy is staring at me going, oh, she's going to throw it, all right? So if they're not looking at me, I do the hup to get them looking at me. But odds are if you've done this right, they're staring, just waiting. So what I'm going to do is they're looking at me, and I will shoot my little cap gun. I will shoot it. And then I will do my hup, and I will throw it. And I only throw it when they're looking. I don't just throw it, I always throw when the puppy's looking. So I'm going to shoot the pistol, hup, throw the bumper. What does the puppy do? Now, 99 out of 100 times, and in my world, 100 out of 100 times, that little dog is going to go, oh, well, and they're going to go get that and come running back to you. If all went well, then on the third and final retrieve, this time, I'll make sure they're looking at me. If they're not, I'll hup. I will shoot it, making sure they look at me. Then I'll throw it. So I'm not doing all the stuff like throwing when it's at the top of the arc like a bird or anything else. I shoot it. They look out there. So now they're associating this thing they love. I hear that pop, and then it goes out. And so, right, if that went well, then tomorrow when you guys go back in a different place, don't do the same thing in the same place. This time when you go out and the puppy's like going, oh, goody, we get to do this, and you're holding on to it, I'm going to shoot, make sure the dog's looking. Throw the puppy dummy. And then I will do that on all the rest. Shoot and throw. Well, now you do that for 2 or 3 days, that gun means you're going to go get it. And so you don't worry about the, like in hunt test, shoot it at, pop has to be at the top of the mark. Don't worry about that stuff right now. We want these little guys to hear that little gun sound and go out and get that. And so from then on, if you possibly can, if you're not, at the park and you'll get arrested, but make sure you're going places where you can do this. Okay, if as often as you can, do your marks, your retrieve stuff with someone else throwing and with that gun. And that's why you don't want to be shooting right over top of them to start. Okay, I know that's how you're going to hunt in a duck blind, but we're going to teach them when you hear that sound, it's the best thing in the world. And you keep it out there. And you don't ever have to shoot over top of them until you start the upland stuff. But by the time you start shooting birds in the upland field, okay, they've had guns on all this stuff, and a gun means heaven is coming. That's how you introduce it, and you stay consistent. It's very good if once you get to that point where you're doing that, that you drive or do whatever you have to do and get out where you can have the shooting with the bumper going down. Later on, when you get on the frozen birds and birds, when you have more control over stuff and the dog isn't going to eat it or take it away or not bring it to you, you know, then you, and what we use, there's shotgun blasters. Shotgun simulators are like big potato guns. Eventually, we quickly move over to the shotgun simulator as soon as we know the dog is gone. This is awesome. And so it is, but it's far out. And for quite a while, like I would say 4 or 5 months, they just have the pistol. And then when we go to the shotgun simulator, it's no big deal. And that's, so you use the passion, you use a very reasonable approach so that you only introduce one new thing at a time. You keep the gun away from them, you start little. You aren't going to have any of that stuff, but it's the passion for retrieving that's what's really important on that. And it really is that simple. 100 out of 100 times for me. Okay, question. Second question. This is a good question. This is from one of my clients who has some very, very fancy dogs. And it was a question about when you have dogs trained for competitive stuff, when you go play the games, whether field trial stuff, hunt test stuff, the pointing lab stuff, when you train to go run the test, so there's a lot of control, right? They've got to be steady, except for the very intro level. No, they have to be steady everywhere, but you can just kind of hold them on the early stuff. But they need to be steady, right? And they have to go to the area of the fall, and they have to come directly back. And then in the upland stuff, you know, we teach them that once you go on point, you hold the point unless the bird repositions. And you've got to wait till the gun goes off, and I send you. And so you have all of this control so that you pass the test. So your dog really understands control, and you have a lot of it, and they clearly understand the game. All right, now it's hunting season. And you're heading to North Dakota, South Dakota. You're going to go grouse hunting. You're going to go, you know, hunting, you know, what chucker in the mat, wherever you guys do that. Just, you're going to go do wild birds. You're going to go to Kansas, you know, where there aren't 800 of them that hit the sky at once. But if you're good and your dog is good, you can go find wild pheasant who know how to stay alive out there. So how do you take this dog where you have really ultimate control or a whole lot of control over them, and then go enjoy and have them be effective hunters? And then one, you know, what do you do with that? Because when the birds don't behave like landed birds, you know, then stuff isn't the same as when we're training and competing. And then also, if you're going to go do some of that kind of stuff, again, the wind is really firing up, so I apologize for any background noise on this. When you do, you know, you're out there hunting wild birds who don't behave the way they're supposed to, and then you want to go back, right, and run tests. And so I've heard a lot of people go, oh, that's not very hard. So it's like, really? Give me the secret, because I've been doing this a long time and it is hard. It is hard. The easiest thing that I have found, since I do the dog training thing for a living, of course I'm going to think that's the most important deal, right? Even hunting, I'm going to think it is. So I realize I'm coming in from that perspective. But then when you're talking about dog training, basically, you're talking about a lot of time. Whether it's your time or a trainer's time, you're talking about a lot of time. And time is money. If you're paying someone to help you with your dog, then that's a lot of money. And if you're taking your time and birds and effort and learning, that's worth a lot of money as well. So I'm going to bottom line this like I do for everybody. If you're listening to this podcast and you do this, odds are there's a lot of investment in this animal, whether it's pure monetary or whether it's your time and effort, which is still monetary. There's still a lot of value in that. So you don't want to just throw it away. How do you get the most out of this? So to me, it doesn't. Now, I haven't hunted in every single possible. I have never hunted a grouse in my life. So I can only relate what I've heard to other people. So I can't come into every kind of hunting thing that you have. But I will say this. There are some what I think should be almost ironclad rules for dog behavior, regardless of what you're doing. absolutely, regardless of what you're doing. So when your dog, and I assume we're talking upland, because waterfowl's not that hard. Stake them out, clip them onto something. Do not let a dog run out where people are shooting, because dogs get killed. So if you've never been around that or seen it, I am not exaggerating, because I can introduce you to a bunch of people who have had their dogs killed. Being out somewhere where they shouldn't have been, or they were out somewhere and somebody shooting, shouldn't have been shooting there with them. So it's important that dogs, that you have certain levels of control over your dog when you're doing this. Again, so you're up, waterfowl hunting, clip them if you have to, stake them onto something, keep them where you are. Do not have them going out where things are happening until it is time. So that's just not a hard one. There's all kind of things on the market. Buy a stakeout, screw a C thing into your blind, give them a little place where they stay and they can see birds go down, but they can't go out and go till you send them. There's a lot of ways to keep dogs under control, just like they would be in competition. I don't know why, even if you're jump shooting, you would ever let a dog just go whenever they felt like it. Just don't, you know, I can't see that, particularly if you're also a competitor. So waterfowl stuff, that's not hard. Keep them where you are until it's time for them to go. If they can't see them, teach them how to handle so that you can get them out there. Also carry a pocket of rocks. Upland stuff, not as straightforward as that. But here are some ultimate things. Even with your really good pointing dogs, they should not be so far away from you that someone else can shoot them, or that they are running all of the wild pheasant out of the field for everybody. So there's dogs should be hunting with you in a way that is meaningful for you. If you compete in upland stuff, now for the pointer, which I have been to pointer field trials, those dogs are so far away from everybody, nobody's seeing anything. I had to see it to believe it. It's like, well, here come the horses. And the dog had already long gone. That's an interesting thing. Okay, the retriever people, no, there's no competition where your dog, you don't know where they are and they're out of sight. That is not useful. So even when you're hunting with these guys, they need to be with you in a workable range, and that's absolute. And they can't go, if you're hunting in stuff that's so deep and thick you can't see them, you're pretty much obligated now to spend the money on those GPS deals they have now, where you can have a collar on your dog that transmit the signal to let you know whether they've stopped moving and where they're located. So, get one of those things. If you're hunting where the CRPs or the grass is over their head, or there's cattails, and they might be on point 30 feet away from you, and you have no idea, right? So that's kind of the way to go if you're going to be hunting and stuff like that, so that you know where they are. Dogs have to hunt with you. And if you're in a field where you can kind of see them, keep them in your gun range, whatever that is. Don't let them learn that, when I'm competing in APLA tests, I got to stay in gun range and I got to do all this stuff. But when I'm out here, heck with that, I can do whatever I want. I don't know why you'd want to do that unless the finding the birds necessitates that. And if it does, let them learn in certain conditions, your gun range expands. But if I draw it back in, you draw it back in. They need to be aware of what, if you're hunting different kind of birds in different kind of situations, they need to understand that. That's an absolute. Now, the pointing thing. So when we train dogs, we go plant birds, and then they have to learn how to be really good at finding them, and then preferably not on top of them, because you can't hunt wild birds if your dog needs to get 2 feet away from the bird. That'll never work. So you need to have a dog that's good and learns, if I get very close to this thing, I lose it. So, and they can learn, the only way you learn to be really good at wild birds is by hunting wild birds. That makes you good. And I know a lot of phenomenal pointing dogs, they learn really well on quail, because you get anywhere close, those dogs are gone. And a really good pointer is going to learn, I got to stay back at first scent. But you can't, whatever you've got, you've got. But one of the things that they can't do is chase. They cannot chase it in the air. Obviously, they can't do that. I don't know why anyone would want that. And again, to all of you guys that go, I know, if I just wing a bird, I need him to go get it. Right, send him. Send him whenever you feel like you need to. But it should be your choice if you have a fully trained Finnish dog. Because the young ones, you can't do that. But you get a fully finished, a bird in the air isn't yours unless I say it is. And you train that way for the fancy games that you play. And you just don't drop that standard when you're hunting. And the same thing on the ground. Unless you send them for an injured bird running on the ground, unless you tell them to go get it, they can't go get it. And if you can keep that clear in your mind, so when you got, you know, those pheasant that are running out the field down the middle of the thing where there's a mowed strip or just an open spot where the tractor drives through, your dog chasing that away from you is of no use to you. So again, that's not in competition. You can't have that. And you can't have that in hunting. Sometimes your range will expand, and that's okay, as long as they understand the rules haven't changed. It's just the ball field has gotten a lot bigger for me. You can do that. Generally, the people that have the biggest problem hunting after a competitive season is when you got a load of dogs out there all hunting together. Now that's a real pet peeve for me. Can you do it? Yes. I have been hunting in South Dakota with all dogs that I trained. Five people, five dogs. Five people, five dogs. We're hunting a big long CRP strip, very long, like 400, 500 yards long. Five dogs, five people. So it was five sets of hunting partners. No dog was hunting over where there was another dog. We had flushers and pointers. We had some of the dogs were flushing dogs. Some of the dogs were pointing dogs. I had one of my Superstar pointing dogs, of course, because they were mine. I got to pick the one I wanted. And we hunted our piece of that. And there was shooting going on. There was flushing dogs on the right side of us. He didn't care at all. Because we were the team deal, and we went through there, and he pointed. Nobody came over here when he went on point. When his bird came up and dropped, nobody else's dog came over and got it, just like he never went over and got anybody else's. So the control that he'd had in all his training, that all of those dogs had had in training, existed right there. Had we turned them loose and gone, hey, all y'all run wherever you want. A couple of them were field champions. A couple of them were four times. None of those guys. It would have been a disaster because those flushing suckers would have just said, hey, wait, every time he stops, I'll go get it. And it would have been a mess. But we hunted all five of them and got that field a whole lot better because it wasn't just this wild frenzy of dogs. And there was no competition. There was no competition. Because my dog hunted with me and the person over there. And some of these people that had never known these dogs before. But the dogs knew, hey, I'm with you. We're walking this direction. I'm going to go out and look for this stuff. And it doesn't matter what's going on way over there or way on the other side. So we just held the standards of every other thing that we do. And it worked really well. And so it can be done. But if you have a dog that's not at that level of experience, then and you're hunting with a bunch of people that like the big turn them loose and let them rock, then go shoot for those guys. Watch one dog steal another dog's bird. Watch the flushing dog run in there on the pointing dog and depoint the pointing dogs. And when it's all done and everyone's happy, take your well-trained control dog and go over on another spot and go ahead. We're going to go over here and look. Fang and I are going to check this out. And go do the thing where there's no competition and nobody that's going to go in there and ruin your stuff. And at that same time, your good dog is going to learn how real birds move and how sometimes, and I know some pointing labs that have gone down to the end of a field where they're running out, they have learned and then come back. And so they're bringing the birds more toward you. So you're going to get a little better yield out of that situation than if you just push them out the other end. Dogs can learn some amazing things, but they don't do it at a party. They do it when they're sitting there learning about these specific things. So, you know, and there's hunting scenarios that I probably don't know about that would be slightly different, but I'll just still say it's still going to be you and your dog. And if it's not, if it's you and your three dogs and somebody else's two dogs and you can't really control three at once, but isn't this a lot of fun? Then you're not about controlling your dog and maintaining the standard. And so you don't control them and you don't maintain the standard. It really comes down to choice, but it can be done. So I know because we did some amazing things up there and those dogs impressed the heck out of me because I saw how well they adjusted to a controlled situation. Last question, because this is going on and on, but it's fun. Hunting season's fun, because then all the work you do is kind of, you get to go reap a lot of the benefits. So the last one is a little bit step back into the more fundamentals, and that is about teaching a dog down. So everybody, some people just really use that a lot, and down is, I like it. It's a real important thing, but I think that our hunting dogs need to be taught that real submissive kind of a response to a command at the right time. So down, let me just say, when you teach a dog to, you know, to lay down, which means bottom and chest are on the floor, on the ground, for some dogs, that is a very, very difficult thing to learn because that is obviously a very submissive position. It's the lack of power position. And so a lot of dogs do not... Again, apologize for the background wind. I can't imagine what this is going to... I hope the house remains here. It's pretty wild outside. It is a very, very submissive lack of power position. And also very useful because of that. So, but don't... I know a lot of people, they get little dogs and they teach them that, especially for a treat. And they lay down. When you teach that very early... on these dogs that are slated for performance, the athletes, the competitive guys, when you teach them that early, at least these guys, that often becomes their default behavior when there's any training thing or pressure going on. So whenever you're, and I know this because I get a lot of dogs in and their owners have taught them down and I know why and it's useful around certain things. And so then I start to teach them that they have to hold a bumper or then reach for and fetch a bumper. And because we've got training pressure and this is challenging and it's kind of unnatural and hard, they want to lay down. Because laying down always made the training pressure go away. And they want to lay down. So now I'm picking a dog up to try and get them to reach for a bumper or, you know, just hold on to it. They just want to lay down. No, everything stops if I do this. So I don't think for the competitive guys and the performance guys, teaching that before you teach some other things is... that's counterproductive. I just fight the heck out of that with dogs that come into me at 6 months already knowing that. You don't want to teach them you relieve training pressure by just flopping yourself on the ground because there's nowhere in competition or hunting where other than wait for something to happen where that's useful. Most of their time is very dynamic. And so we want them that to be the bigger thing that they do, not the, oh no, training pressure, laying down on the ground. So be careful about that. I think you can teach these guys when they're, as soon as they can grasp it and understand it, to sit and to walk with you for the retrievers. You know, teach them to wait, go get stuff, come back to you, you know, preferably sit down to start and to finish. And don't make sit the biggest thing in the world for a little puppy. We want the passion thing first. Always want the passion thing first, and that's going and getting it and coming back. So then you got sit. I think down is highly useful in a lot of ways. For one, it's really nice in the house. If you have a dog that, you know, if the doorbell rings or somebody knocks on the door, it goes ballistic at the door, then you teach him whenever you hear a doorbell or a knock, you go lay down on this rug or this bed or this crate or whatever. So there's a good place for it. It's like... anytime you hear that sound, that means go lay down over here. So it's very useful that way. It's very useful in the holding blind. If you have one of those dogs that likes to jump and be crazy and just get all wound up in a holding blind, teach them when we go in the holding blind, you lay down. So then they go lay down. It's hard to jump up and down and cheat and all. They can kind of peek under, but that's another good place for down. Down is a really good place when a dog needs to yield to you and not be in the middle of stuff. So it's really nice in the house. It's really nice. Maybe sometimes in the yard. It's like, if you go over there and lay down, Fang and I are going to do something. You just wait over there. And sometimes it's just a really good way to get the dog to submit. And I mean, not just to submit mentally. Go, all right, I got to do what you say. I'll just stay over here. I don't get my way. That's a real important thing. But not before you've taught them the passion things. I think you need to have that first so they don't just default to laying down. Because as a trainer who has to deal with that, I can tell as soon as I start being demanding and the dog tries to lay down, oh, goody, they taught this dog down. So now we're going to have to undown for a while before and I have to, you know, reprogram them a little bit to get them to do what they got this dog to do. So down is really useful, but ideally I wouldn't do it until the dog has good obedience. The dog retrieves well, if it's a retriever, does whatever their thing is, delivers stuff to hand, is controllable and stuff. I can call them, they come, they do all that stuff. Now I'm going to teach them this new additive thing onto the behavior that's been fully established, that sometimes I'm going to tell you to drop it to the ground and stay there, and you have to do it. And I don't, you know, I don't do it. I do it with a leash, and I don't touch them and push them down because they'll make you do that all the time. I literally put my foot on the end of the choke chain and just make them go to the ground. And it takes about, for most dogs, 2 or 3 days. And they at least get the idea. And then another week of that, and they're going, yeah, okay, I'll do it. But it's not their default behavior for any kind of training pressure. So down is a real good thing. Just keep it in its right spot. Teach it. It's easier to teach it when they're young than after they get a little older, because it's real submissive and it's hard to make them be submissive that way when they've never had to be. So down's a good one on that. Okay, wrapping this up. Crazy times, crazy world. I got to tell everybody on my prior podcast about, you know, learning to be a better trainer when you're all by yourself with your dog. I had quite a number of people contact me and go, you did that about me, didn't you? I don't know, it was guilt or I don't know what that was, but a lot of people took that real personal, which is, no, I rarely just pick some person out and go, all right, I'm going to just address this. So I don't know, it hit close to home with a lot of people, and I'm glad, because I know a lot of people listening to this really care about what they're doing and are really trying to get just a little bit better. And so God bless all of you. That's the whole point of all of this. You know, we're all just in this crazy world right now trying to get through. And sometimes one of our greatest sanity places, right, is when you're out there with your dog and you get to know yourself. These guys introduce you to you better than just about anything I know. And so nothing is personal about any of you, but it's, you know, maybe I touched in there in a little spot between you and your dog. These guys are just a godsend in how they help us and what they can do, particularly when you open yourself up to that. And so I hope that, you know, I hope everybody just keeps doing that. But I just want to say, look, you know, whenever it's a tough time or a difficult time or a crazy time or whatever, I'd say one of the biggest sanity finders in the planet is that buddy of yours laying on the floor next to you or sitting in the car next to you while you're listening to this or whatever it is. And appreciate that. And most of all, use it, because they can just point out the good things about you. They can point out that, you know, really we're buddies and life isn't so bad because we got each other. There's a whole lot of that. And I hope you guys relish that and enjoy that, because that's one of the reasons you're doing this, and it's just one of the best things possible. So no, it wasn't aimed at any of you, but spend some time with your dog and smile a little bit and make the most of that, because it really is such a precious, precious thing, and we're all so lucky to have those guys in our lives. So haven't blown away yet. If you never hear from me again, I blew to, looks like Mexico, the way this thing's going. And so if I make it back, I'll be back soon with a new topic. And thanks, everybody, for the awesome feedback. And stay sane if you can.